Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from appellant in Computer Associates versus Altai.
Throughout the Miller will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please the court? With me at the council table today is my partner, Steve Kahn, who tried this case once and has appealed it twice. Computer Associates is the designated appellant because two questions have been certified to this court by the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. In 1884, the H.C. Frick Coal Company dug a tunnel under the land of an adjoining landowner, Julius Louis, near Connorsville, Pennsylvania, and secretly removed approximately 4,000 bushels of coal. 7 years later, in 1891, Julius Louis discovered that the coal had been taken and brought suit. This was one of the seminal cases that applied the discovery rule and that articulated the rationale for that rule. In 1984, 100 years later, a computer programmer named Charles F. Arney, working for appellant Computer Associates, was offered a job with Appley Altai to develop a computer program similar to one he had been working on at Computer Associates. Before he left, he took a paper copy of the source code of that program with him. And in his new job, he secretly, with regard to Computer Associates, copied approximately 30% of the new program he was writing, called Oscar 3.4, from the program he had taken from his prior employer, Computer Associates, that program being called Adapter. Mr. Arney admitted that he understood this as a violation of the confidentiality agreement he had signed at Computer Associates. He lied in his exit interview when he told Computer Associates he had no proprietary information, and he misrepresented his intent with regard to not using any proprietary information. If we go back to the discovery rule and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, what it said about the misappropriation of coal in 1884 applies perfectly to the misappropriation of computer source code in 1994. This court quoted with approval in Gaddis versus Smith in 1967 this short passage. To require an owner under such circumstances to take notice of a trespass upon his underlying coal at the time it takes place is to require an impossibility, and to hold that the statute begins to run at the date of the trespass is in most cases to take away the remedy of the injured party before he can know that an injury has been done him. A result so absurd and so unjust ought not to be possible. The facts before this court are exceptionally clean. Trial counsel for Appley Altai stated in open court, quote, "We are not contending that they," and he was referring to Computer Associates, "knew or should have known about this misappropriation or theft more than 2 years prior to filing the lawsuit."
Is it your argument that there should be a universal discovery rule for all causes of action, or merely that we should continue our practice of recognizing those for particular types of actions and extend that to tracing?
We believe that the question certified by the Second Circuit has to do with the class of cases they have designated as misappropriation of trade secrets. There may well be cases about trade secrets that are not misappropriation cases, and we don't think those cases are before the court. We believe that misappropriation of trade secrets is one of those categories of cases which should be recognized as requiring a discovery rule because discovery of the injury is inherently difficult.
Your argument would apply with equal force to every case, would it not?
Don't believe so. And I was going to try to add something to what was in the briefs, and it seemed to me that one of the things that is difficult to dig out of the briefs is the inherent difficulty of detecting the misappropriation of trade secrets. If you look at the line of cases that this court has developed, actually probably the earliest case, the Quinn case, has to do with fraud. But then the Gaddis case, which has to do with medical products, and cases having to do with false credit reporting, cases having to do with legal malpractice and other surgical cases, all emphasize the inherent difficulty, not impossibility, but difficulty of detecting the injury. Emphasis here on the injury, not the extent of damage or all the elements of the cause of action. In trade secrets, it seems to me that there are the same two kinds of barriers to discovering misappropriation that were present in the Cole case, and that's why I think it's such a good analogy. If you look at the situation Mr. Louie faced, there was a physical barrier to knowing that he had been injured. He couldn't see the tunnel. He had no way to know the tunnel was under his land. There was also a legal barrier. He couldn't go over and map the pits that were dug in the land next to him because he would violate the same law that protected him, which was trespass law. Those same two precise barriers are present in the class of cases that deals with misappropriation of trade secrets. Computer code illustrates this very well. It is not the misappropriated computer code that is put into a line of commerce and that becomes somewhat visible. It is what's made with the misappropriated trade secret that goes out into the public domain, if you will. There was a footnote that was fairly
When it does, can't you see at that point what that code is and make a decision about whether you think it was based upon yours or not?
No, you cannot, for two reasons. As the Court of Appeals pointed out, there's a difference between source code and object code. Computers run on ones and zeros. They run on binary code called object code that is absolutely unintelligible to human beings. In order for human beings to be able to tell one computer how to make object code for another, they use what's called source code, which is written in a higher level language such as COBOL, Fortran, Ada, Basic, Pascal. It looks a little like English, and it has things that say things like go to a certain step, write to disk, save, print. It has a lot of if statements that say if this condition is true, then do that. All of this is translated through several levels into ones and zeros. If one has object code, it is almost impossible, it was actually a fluke in this case, to figure out whether the object code comes from your source code or a completely different source code that produces very similar looking object code. So the first thing you have to understand is it was not the source code that was out in the marketplace, but what the source code was used to do. If you think about someone stealing the formula for Coca-Cola, or maybe let's do it the other way. Let's say that Coca-Cola were going to bring out a product that tasted more like Pepsi and call it New Coke. It would be very difficult for Pepsi to tell whether they did their formulation independently or somewhere they had a copy of the formula for Pepsi that they used, because what you would see is the product. You would not see the formula, the recipe, if you will. That's the first point. The second point is, these were mainframe computer programs, and it's a little easier to understand. We're not talking about stuff in shrink wrap at a software store. Licensing agreements prevented computer associates under normal circumstances from even seeing the object code. The people who had the object code were not supposed to provide that to other people under the licensing agreements. It was a fluke by which a customer asked computer associates to help them because they couldn't get some support from Altai with a problem that was very similar to a problem in Adapter, that they discovered that it was the same problem in both programs because they came from the same source. So it's a fluke when this is discovered. And that is, I think, one of the reasons this question has not been before this court before. It is very unusual that one is able to discover the misappropriation of trade secrets. And the only way in normal circumstances that happens is through a fluke or through very careful analysis of things that are hard to detect. No one has suggested in the other discovery rule cases that it's impossible. It's just difficult. It's not impossible to discover a sponge that's been left behind. It just requires an operation. And in the coal company case, it would have required Mr. Louie to go over and trespass to violate the very law that protected him to find out that there were tunnels under his land, or to do something very unreasonable, which was presumably to dig down under his land. The same thing would be required in almost all trade secret cases. One would have to encourage industrial espionage to try to determine whether someone else was producing a new product with your underlying trade secrets or with an independent development.
There does not appear to be a way to limit the principle that you are urging from applying in every circumstance, so that the discovery rule would then be the rule for all limitations, questions, and taxes.
Well, we don't believe so, Your Honor. Let me try to speak to that.
Why would there be another case which didn't involve coal and didn't involve source code, but it didn't involve sponges, but it did involve something else that was just as hard to find out about that this wouldn't apply to?
Well, because the only question that is before the court is misappropriation of trade secrets. And we believe that is quite different from for example, from misdiagnosis of medical conditions, which is one of the medical situations where the court has made distinction. We think, first of all, that the inherent difficulty element is present, which is critical. Another thing is, in the misappropriation of trade secret situation, there almost always is some physical evidence that a wrong has been done. Because as in this case, when you get into discovery and you're able to get the proprietary information of the party alleged to have misappropriated a secret, it's possible to trace their engineering history and to find out if it came from an independent source or if they, in fact, started with some kind of improper information. So this is a category of cases, we think, defined properly by the Second Circuit as misappropriation of trade secrets that we think is definable, it's understandable, and we think it has all the elements that the court has used in other category by category cases. We think that another point is that the critical touchstone here is injury. Injury is not known in misappropriation of trade secret cases. Nothing is missing when a trade secret is misappropriated. There's no missing box, there's no missing diamond, there's no something that's broken into. Copies are freely made. This was a paper copy of a program. The valuable part of the program was not usually a paper copy. It was a lot of trouble to re-enter 6,000 lines of code. The valuable part of that was the tape, which might be accounted for, or the disk, which might be accounted for. As I think all of us recognize who use computers at all, making a copy of a disk is almost an instantaneous operation. And if we consider as lawyers how difficult it is to control the flow of privileged information around our firms, we all recognize we wouldn't say that we were guilty, I think, of failure to safeguard our secrets if we found that a legal assistant, for example, had taken some privileged information and secretly disclosed it to another employer. I think we'd all recognize that the fact that they could have a copy of privileged information is something that's just inherent in their job. And that's true with all these kinds of trade secrets. It's inherent in a programmer's job to live with source code. That's what they do, is write this stuff, change it, fix it, get up in the middle of the night and correct bugs in it. And once that copy's gone, you can't tell that it's gone. So I think the injury detection point is really crucial in all the cases that this court has determined. We think that, by the way, the court can...
Excuse me. Let's talk about this injury detection. Is it easier for a prospective employer to guard against an employee working on a project from, unbeknownst to anybody else, inputting into the project the employee's own knowledge? Is that easier to protect against by the prospective employer, or is it easier to protect against the loss of that knowledge by the former employer restricting access to hard copies of the trade secrets? In other words, you're arguing for discovery rule so that your employer has a cause of action when the employer learns that some information had been taken somewhere down the road. But on the other hand, if you use the discovery rule, it seems to shift the risk of the loss of this trade secret to an subsequent employer, such as is argued in this case, Altai. He said, we just hired him and we put him on a project. We had no idea he was inputting into that project. We had no idea that he was inputting that project something that he had taken from his other employer. Shouldn't the risk be on the former employer to guard against the taking of the information?
Well,
We don't believe that the risk should be on the former employer. For one thing, the former employer has no control. I mean, in this particular instance, Computer Associates had a written confidentiality agreement. They debriefed the employee when he left, gave him assurances that were false. We believe that any person who is doing development should be monitoring and can easily be monitoring their people to make sure that they're getting independent development and that they're not getting plagiarism. That's no different than publishers trying to protect against plagiarism or anyone else trying to protect against plagiarism. I would stress, however, that there is a doctrine that if the employer is completely unaware of the misuse of a trade secret by an employee, it may not be a misappropriation. That is not the case here with regard to the part of this case that is primarily active, which has to do with Oscar 3.5, that was an effort to re-engineer this program after it was known by the employer that they had a misappropriated copy of the source code in their possession. So we are not talking about a situation where there is no intent and there is no fault. That's not an issue when you're talking about misappropriation. I see that my time is up.
Let me ask you a question before you sit down, Mr. Miller. In addition to answering the two questions certified to us by the Second Circuit, do we also, in addition, have to answer the question of whether or not the 1 or 2 year statute of limitation applies? Or can we avoid that?
I don't believe that question is before the court, and I think the court has noted before that in certified questions you are limited to the question certified, and we think that's not an issue that's before the court.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your
Honor. The court is ready to hear argument from appellee.
May it please the court, Mr. William Powers will submit argument for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court? I'd like to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, because it's not altogether clear exactly what they're arguing in this case. Many of their arguments are just that it's unfair to bar a claim before the plaintiff has a reasonable chance to discover. And that is an argument that the discovery rule should apply to every case, not just trade secret cases. So if the rationale is it's unfair to bar a claim before the plaintiff has a reasonable chance to discover it, that is tantamount to saying the discovery rule will apply in every case. And that's just not Texas law. That's never been Texas law. This court has always said the discovery rule, or the non-discovery rule, is the normal rule in Texas. The court said that even in cases where it's carved out an exception. It said it in Trinity River Authority. It said it in Willis versus Maverick. It said it in Gaddis versus Smith. In every case this court has dealt with the discovery rule, it is said that the normal rule in Texas is the non-discovery rule. So to the extent they're arguing this general principle, it is simply inconsistent with Texas law. And in fact, we agree that there's some intuitive appeal to the idea that plaintiffs should have a reasonable chance to discover the injury. But that's not the only side of the argument. The other side of the argument, the other side of the issue, is that the whole purpose of statutes of limitation are to give repose. Give repose to businesses and individuals from old claims. That's why the court has repeatedly said the non-discovery rule is the traditional applicable rule in Texas. If we don't give people repose from old claims, they have to defend with old evidence. They can never close their books on contingent liability. They can never get out from under the need for claims-made insurance. They can never get out from under the insurance tail. So repose is an important value on the other side of this debate. And it would be inconsistent with Texas law to follow their suggestion that any time the plaintiff can't reasonably discover an injury, then the discovery rule should be applied. That would be inconsistent with the purposes of repose, and it would be inconsistent with all of the Texas cases that have spoken on this issue.
Why is this case any less compelling than those cases in which we've applied the discovery rule?
Well, that's the other part of their argument, that this ought to be an exception to the discovery rule. And we don't think it's like those other cases. And I'd like to go through the kinds of cases they argue that this case is like. One of their arguments, based on Kelly versus Wrinkle, is that trade secret misappropriation is inherently undiscoverable. Of course, the facts here aren't anything like Kelly versus Franklin. Right? That exception was developed in a case, and it's important to understand the facts of Kelly. It was a very extreme factual situation. Right? The plaintiff, or the defendant, I'm sorry, the defendant supplied credit information to a credit agency that just put it in the file. That's all that happened. And according to the technical laws of defamation, that's when the legal injury occurred. It was in a credit agency file that had never been disseminated. Then when it was disseminated, the plaintiff was injured in a real sense, suffered real harm, and the court started the statute of limitations at that point. It's understandable why the court wouldn't want to start the statute of limitations when something was in the file of a credit agency. It wasn't just hard to discover. The plaintiff wouldn't even know where to go look for that file. Right? It was virtually impossible to discover. It was virtually unknowable. So that's a very extreme factual pattern.
Should the rule be different in cases of intentional wrongdoing?
Well, that's the one part of their argument is this is inherently undiscoverable. And we don't think it is. And I'll return to facts of the case that show that, that this is not inherently undiscoverable. But then they talk about the fact and conjure up the idea that if we had a non-discovery rule in this type of case, it would be a haven for thieves. We could simply steal the material, sit on it for 2 years, and then use it with impunity. And that this is somehow intentional wrongdoing. Now, Arnie, that is the employees, act was intentional wrongdoing. We think Arnie intentionally concealed facts from the plaintiff, engaged in theft. And we think there's already a Texas exception to the non-discovery rule to take care of that case. That is, if the plaintiff, if the defendant actively conceals facts, which will be the case in theft, actively conceals facts from the plaintiff, well, the statute of limitations is running. But that's already an exception to the non-discovery rule in Texas. The discovery rule would be applied. Fraud cases are that type of case, actively concealing the facts from the plaintiff. Fraudulent concealment cases. The Cole case, the Pennsylvania Cole case that the plaintiffs rely on so heavily, that's a case where not only is it difficult to discover, but the defendant in that Cole case is actively trying to deceive the plaintiff. So we fully agree that if the defendant actively tries to conceal facts from the plaintiff, the discovery rule should apply. There ought to be an exception. But there's already an exception for that in the fraud and fraudulent concealment case. But that's not what happened here. The trial judge, and let me read from the trial judge's findings here. The trial judge specifically held no one at all time, other than Arnie, knew that Arnie had the adapter code or that he'd referred to it when he was writing Oscar VSE, a project that took him 3 months, or when he was writing Oscar VMS, that's the other program. Only when this lawsuit was commenced did Altai learn that Arnie had copied some 30% of the Oscar code. So the discovery rule applied to Arnie makes sense. It falls within an exception, an existing exception to the traditional rule. But that's not us. Now they come back and argue that when we developed after the lawsuit started, and we developed Oscar 3.5, well, at that point, we somehow knew that Arnie had used our code. But by that point, the lawsuit had already started. By the time we knew anything about this, the lawsuit had already started. We never tried, you know, when we knew the facts, we didn't try and conceal anything from the plaintiff. To follow up on that point, so we never actively concealed facts. We never actively concealed facts from the plaintiff at all. But even when we learned of the facts, that wasn't when the statute of limitations was running. The lawsuit had already begun. The exception that is already in Texas law is that if we actively conceal facts, we steal something, we dig under their land, we conceal what we're doing from the plaintiff, while the statute of limitations is running, we agree the discovery rule should apply. That's simply not our case.
One of the goals this court often attempts to achieve
and that you've urged on us in the past in some briefs, I think, is uniformity with other states. And opposing counsel asserts that every other state high court that's looked at this question has recognized the discovery rule in misappropriation of trade secrets, and you don't rebut that in your brief directly, as you come up with a reason why Texas law should be different. But if we're unique on injunctions, is it a sounder public policy for us to get rid of the two places where we're apparently unique and come into line with the rest of the national law?
Of course, the issue on perpetual injunctions isn't before the court, so we're in a little bit of a box on that problem. We only have the discovery rule in front of us at this point. But the reason, and it's important to understand the reason that these other states follow the discovery rule. 39 of those states have passed the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. The Uniform Trade Secrets Act calls for a discovery rule across the board in all trade secret cases. That's why those courts have adopted the discovery rule. It hasn't been common law development. Their legislatures adopted the act. Now, two other states, as a matter of their own common law, have followed the discovery rule. Then there are four federal courts making eerie guesses. Well, that's not making judgments on what they think is the best policy. And when a court's making an eerie guess about what states will do, you know, the majority rule is going to have some control. So this overwhelming preference for the discovery rule really is one event. That's legislatures adopting the Uniform Trade Secrets Act.
But 39 have done it by statute, is that right?
That's correct. 39 have done it by statute.
And two have done it on their own initiative as a part of the common law, as we're being asked to do today.
That's correct.
And two more states, the federal courts...
Four more states.
The federal courts have said, again, that under Erie, the common law that the state courts would develop would be consistent with what we've been asked to do today.
They've predicted that that's what the state court would do. Although I would assert again that in an eerie guess, federal courts aren't really making their own policy and analyzing the issues in an independent way as a common law court would. They're trying to guess what the state court would do. And the two courts are not interested at all.
That leaves us in a rather distinct minority, doesn't it?
It does leave us in a minority, but it leaves us in a minority because Texas didn't adopt the Uniform Act. We're in a minority on anything that the Act controls. And the Act has other features as well. For example, the Act prohibits these perpetual injunctions. Perpetual injunctions, meaning that an injunction to enjoin a defendant from using what once was trade secret material, from using that material even after it's in the public domain, even after all of the other competitors of both the defendant and the plaintiff can use it. These perpetual injunctions prohibit the defendant from using that material as a penalty, not as a remedy for injury during the time it was a trade secret. Texas law permits those. The Trade Secret Act forbids them. So there are differences in several ways.
So if we were to adopt the approach urged on us today under Texas law, perpetual injunction would still be prohibited. Is that right?
No, Texas does not prohibit perpetual injunctions. Texas, under the Huffines case, is one of the few states that does permit perpetual injunctions, and they are forbidden by the Act. Now, in their reply brief, the plaintiff comes back with some cases saying that's not true. None of those cases that they cite in the reply brief, and we invite you to go look at them, even talks about injunctions after the material becomes a trade secret. In fact, one of the cases they cite actually says, of course, after this becomes public information, then the injunction would have to end. So none of those, Texas is not unique, but virtually unique in permitting these perpetual injunctions. And notice the position that puts the defendant in. The defendant could unknowingly develop a product, have an employee use a trade secret, unbeknownst to the employer. Remember, what's a trade secret and what's not is a very fuzzy issue. It's not going to be a clear-cut line. I thought I was using something that everybody knew about. I didn't realize that was a trade secret. The defendant then builds an entire product line and finds out years later that his technological foundation has been undermined because it can be enjoined from selling those products. It's not just damages. It can be enjoined from selling those products because of something that happened years before, unbeknownst.
As you know, we have an exception for active concealment.
That's correct.
And as you suggest, the employee actively concealed.
The employee did.
Why isn't his action, a company can't work except through its employees. Why isn't his employer responsible for his actions?
Well, they're not alleging vicarious liability here. They've never alleged vicarious liability. And there are reasons why there ought not be vicarious liability in trade secret cases, in all trade secret cases, because of this problem of undermining the technological foundation of a company in the future. But that's not this case. They are not alleging that somehow we're vicariously liable. The copyright claim was because something came out in our products that was in the copyright. The trade secret claim is our products came out using their trade secrets. They're talking about our conduct. They're not making a vicarious liability claim. Now, if they did, we'd then have to address how far vicarious liability applies to trade secret cases. And we would argue that it ought not be as fully applicable. As soon as we find out about the material, we make what the Second Circuit said were honest and good and reasonable efforts to clean up the situation. And we pay damages on the copyright violation. I'd like to turn back to the other wing of their argument, not the act of concealment, the Cole case, but the inherently undiscoverable aspects of the case. Again, they try and equate this situation with the very extreme facts of Kelly, where this court developed the inherently undiscoverable distinction. But that's just not trade secrets as a category of cases. In fact, it's ironic that they are coming in here and saying this is inherently undiscoverable. There's no way to discover it. It doesn't leave any trace. Well, let's look at even the facts of this case. Arnie took computer paper from their company. They can keep logs of that. They can keep physical control over the physical manifestations or the physical embodiments of their trade secrets. Now, sometimes a trade secret may be intangible, but other times it's not intangible. It's embodied in physical documents, as it was in this case. And moreover, the trade secret very often will be embodied in a product unbeknownst to us that we put out. And in fact, that's how they discovered the trade secret, or that's how they discovered the alleged trade secret in this case. They disassembled, that's the right word, one of our programs in 1988. It was out on the market, they disassembled. They were able to discover at that point that there was some of their code at the basis of this program. That product was out on the market in 1985, well before the statute of limitations, more than 2 years before the lawsuit was brought. The same information that they actually used to find out about this alleged misappropriation.
You're suggesting that any similar program which hits the market imposes a duty on them to immediately disassemble it to discover if there's any common basis?
No, I'm not saying that if we were applying the discovery rule, it was unreasonable for them not to disassemble it. But if the discovery rule were applicable to this case, we'd have to battle that out in the trial court. You know, were they on enough notice? Should they have disassembled it? Should they have discovered the injuries? But they're arguing not what should happen if we apply the discovery rule, but they're arguing that we should apply the discovery rule, that is, we should not follow the traditional rule in Texas. We should follow the discovery rule because it was virtually impossible, it's inherently undiscoverable under these circumstances, because trade secret theft, they claim, leaves no trace. Well, it left enough of a trace that they were able to find it in 1988 with exactly the same information, the same product that was out there in 1985. It's hard to see how it's virtually impossible, inherently undiscoverable.
What reason did they have to look for that crime? What reasonable motive?
Well, there are a lot of things in trade secret cases that are not like, for example, Kelly. Remember, Kelly was a very extreme set of circumstances. In trade secret cases, they know when an employee leaves and goes to a competitor. And in fact, this court has said that's an inherently suspicious circumstance. There's physical embodiments of the trade secret that might be missing, as there was in this case.
So, in other words, it's incumbent upon everyone in the industry to be totally paranoid all the time.
Well, the law already puts a trade secret law already puts a duty on them to protect their trade secrets. But we're not arguing that necessarily they were unreasonable. That would be applying the discovery rule. We're just saying it doesn't fit into this inherently undiscoverable category of virtually impossible to discover. And I'd like to make a point about both of those exceptions and also the difference in Texas law and the law of other states. It is not the law of Texas that you can never apply the discovery rule to a trade secret case. If the trade secret really is inherently undiscoverable, rare fact situation, but if it's really inherently undiscoverable, it really has not left a trace. That's not this case. But if the plaintiff can prove that, we agree that the inherently undiscoverable, the Kelly versus Wrinkle exception, would be applicable. They can try and prove that. Or if they can prove that we actively tried to conceal facts from the plaintiff, they could try and get it into that exception. So it's not as though Texas law would never protect trade secrets. When necessary, when they're stolen, when it's trade secret theft, when we actively conceal, in that situation, apply the discovery rule. In the case where it really is inherently undiscoverable, looking at the facts of the case, company gives something to the FDA, it's leaked, the company has no reason to be suspicious, whatever. There might be inherently undiscoverable cases and trade secret cases. Apply them. But that's not what the plaintiffs are asking, and that's not what the certified question asks. The certified question asks, are you going to apply the discovery rule to every trade secret case across the board, irrespective of the facts of the particular case? Mm-hmm. Texas law raises, protects against the problems they are asserting. There's no need to fix it.
Any questions?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor.
I'd like to begin by making clear what the certified question says about knowledge or reason to know. The certified question on page 7 says, Altai conceded at trial that CA did not know or have reason to know of Altai's alleged misappropriation until 1988. Thus, if the discovery rule applied in this case, CA's misappropriation claims would be timely under Texas law. This is very much like a summary judgment in which a court says, I'm not going to deal with the underlying facts because I find the law doesn't exist. What the district judge did was say, I had 6 days of trial testimony and some expert reports, and I'm not going to look to see how the trade secrets exist, particularly in the Oscar 3.5 program, the second one that was re-engineered after they had knowledge, because I find that the Texas Supreme Court has never applied the discovery rule. If I could certify a question to them, I would. Maybe the Second Circuit would like to certify, but I won't extend that Texas law. So because as a matter of law, I find the discovery rule is not available, I'm not going to develop the facts. This court can't develop the facts either.
Thank you. I guess a fundamental question about liability, Professor Powers. Argued that this is not a vicarious liability situation, that they concede the employee acted intentionally and was a wrongdoer, but that until after this lawsuit was filed, they were totally ignorant of the underlying basis for this program, and that they are guilty of no wrongdoing. What is the basis for their liability?
Well, it was the position of Computer Associates and the basis on which the case was tried that there had to be either actual or constructive notice. With regard to the second program that was developed, called OSCAR 3.5, there was actual notice, because at that point, and that's primarily what the trade secret issues are about, because what they did was to try to re-engineer the program. With regard to constructive notice, there will be a remand if this court says yes to question number one, and a determination will be made as to how much constructive notice applied. There's evidence that Mr. Williams had an office right next to Mr. Arney, and there's a credibility issue as to whether he in fact knew that there was copying going on. So we believe that those facts are yet to be developed. We think that constructive notice is a form of vicarious liability. If I might briefly respond to a couple of other points.
Before you move on, Mr. Miller,
yes.
Has the trial court already ruled on that OSCAR 3.5 that there was no copyright infringement as to that program?
It has only ruled
that
there are two separate groups of claims. The trade secret protection is much broader than copyright protection. Trade secret protection includes things like process and method. All that has been determined so far on OSCAR 3.5 is that it was not a copyright violation under federal copyright law. The real fight here is over whether a much larger liability exists, because 3.5 is much more widely distributed, is, we believe, still in use today, a much longer period of damage, as to whether there are trade secrets that were used, even though they simply used those trade secrets and did not literally copy all the source code. In other words, they had the methods, they had the techniques, the parameter lists, the structure, other things which would be trade secrets. So the trial court has not addressed that issue. That's on remand. Very briefly, in the minute or two I have left, this court has dealt with the open courts provision before. I think it's important to recognize that's a strong statement of public policy in Texas, that litigants who could not reasonably discover their injury should have access to the courts. It is not an inherently undiscoverable rule. That's a phrase used by the Fifth Circuit. This court has said difficult to discover. We don't think the standard is inherently undiscoverable. It's not inherently undiscoverable that someone has a swab in them or that someone has a bad credit report. It's just difficult to
you
discover.
You think difficult to discover is a constitutional standard?
No, Chief Justice. I think all I'm saying is that the constitutional standard, we believe, is a strong public policy that says that in cases where a litigant had not, in fact, discovered their injury, and it would be very difficult to discover the injury, it would be a denial of reasonable access to the courts. That's what the court has said before.
I'm trying to get the standard. You say it's not difficult. Is it very difficult? And that's a constitutional standard.
I think
that
it's
applies to a statute that sets a 2-year statute of limitations and to our decision of when to start that 2-year run.
I don't think that the constitutional standard is invoked here, because I think the court avoids reaching the constitutional issue by saying yes to question number one. I think the constitutional issue is primarily a codification of public policy, which says that there is a strong public policy that favors injured parties having reasonable access to the courts. And we think that industries that develop trade secrets, which are vital to Texas, need that kind of protection. Otherwise, we're going to be saying they don't have any reasonable remedy if their trade secrets are taken and simply not used for 2 years.
Let me ask a question just to be short. The statute of limitations talks about the length of time. Up to this court generally to say when the time runs. That's what when that time starts running, and that's the discovery.
That's correct.
The opposition says that we've never applied the open courts doctrine to a court ruling as opposed to legislation. Is that correct, or is that beside the point?
Well, I think we believe that that's beside the point. We presume that this court is going to act constitutionally and that it will use the constitutional provision as an input to its decision, and we think it's an important input to answer question number one.
That would be an unconstitutional decision.
Presumably, whatever decision this court makes, it's going to be a constitutional decision. We think that the constitutional mandate is a strong reason to answer yes to question number one. And we think
and
that
again,
it can be used to interpret the legislative intent on a cruise. The legislature, when it did not define a cruise more narrowly as it did in the wrongful death statute, knew about the open courts provision and would have assumed that in circumstances when a cruise would have unreasonably closed the courts, that the courts would interpret it consistent with the Constitution to protect litigants, as it has in other cases like this, where it is inherently difficult to discover the injury and where there is sufficient certainty that the injury has occurred, that you can go back without violating the fairness of the statute of limitations and reconstruct the facts sometime later. And we believe all those factors apply in the category of misappropriation of trade secrets.
Any other questions?
I have one question, very quickly. It's yes or no. Are you aware of any situation where Texas courts have applied the doctrine of repose in the absence of a statute of repose?
I believe a statute of repose is different from a statute of limitations. A statute of repose normally is an absolute rule that, such as in the case of the architect.
We have statutes of repose that are applied to very limited circumstances. Is there any case where our courts have applied a doctrine of repose in the absence of a specific statute?
I'm not aware of any doctrine of repose that has been judicially created in the absence of the statute.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will take another brief recess.